Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on this Aloha Friday, August 30th. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. Labor Day is just around the corner, so today we've got a Hanaho show featuring interesting people with some really cool jobs. We talked to a marine archaeologist who's mapping World War II shipwrecks in Micronesia, vessels that ended up on the ocean floor as payback for the Pearl Harbor bombing. We'll also revisit an interview with a researcher who links bites from the cookie-cutter shark to a phase of the moon. And we catch up with a Punahou graduate who recently won her second Emmy Award for her work on the HBO series Succession. Plus, we talk to two local women who launched their brand of fruit-flavored gummies called Better Sour. Tune to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Payback for Pearl Harbor. That is how Chuuk Lagoon became a watery graveyard for scores of shipwrecks and Japanese aircraft. The Micronesian islands of Chuuk, or Truk, had become a key strategic seaplane and submarine base for Japan during World War II. The U.S. bombed the base, and when it was all over, some 5,000 Japanese soldiers and 1,000 Chuukese villagers were killed. Now, thanks to a grant from the American Battlefield Protection Program, work will begin on mapping a group of sunken ships that were never surveyed. William Jeffrey has worked as a marine archaeologist for 4 decades. He's a professor at the University of Guam and is spearheading the expedition to explore the wrecks and to include the islander stories about this battle in the Pacific.
Chuukese people have been living there for about 2,000 years and have had several colonial rulers from the Spanish, the Germans, Japanese and the Americans. It's mainly during the Japanese period, some from 1914 to 1945, that had the biggest impact on Chuukese people, mainly because of the build-up to the war. The war really started when the bombing started in February 1944. The Americans regarded Chuuk, or Truk as it's called then, as the equivalent to their Pearl Harbor. So it was seen as a very important strategic base that on their road back to sort of pushing the Japanese back into Japan, they wanted to neutralize the base. So they actually, one time, they thought of actually dropping an atomic bomb in June 1944, but they found that the bombing that they'd done in February had neutralized it fairly well, so they didn't do that, thankfully. But they sent in wave after wave. It was actually 10 times more aircraft than they Japanese sent into Pearl Harbor and bombed it in February 44, then again in April, May 44, and then subsequently for the next 3.5 years from B-24, B-29s and the Marshall Islands to sort of keep it neutral because the Americans were wanting to fight and push the Japanese out of the Philippines and then back into Japan. They wanted to neutralize this, that big base that they called Truk Lagoon. So it was promoted as a payback in all the press after the bombing as a payback to Pearl Harbor. And the Chuukese were, well, greatly impacted. Many people lost their lives. They were pushed away from their homes, their home islands. You know, they lost their land. They lost their cultural identity because their land is essentially part of their cultural identity.
You know, we share that feeling here in Hawaii as well, as it is for many Pacific Islanders. So during that time, I'm reading that there are 1,000 Chuukese who died and 5,000 Japanese troops?
Yes, that's correct. There's probably about 40,000 troops, Japanese troops and civilians and construction workers, and about 10,000 Chuukese living there at the time. Many of the Japanese, about 4,000, died on the ships at worst. So about 50 to 60 ships, although around the whole of the lagoon, outside about 110 ships altogether during the war were sunk in and around Truk. And it was the bombing in February and then May 1944 was the greatest merchant ship loss by the Japanese up until that time in the war. It remains one of the most significant loss of merchant ships. The Japanese were aware that the Americans were looking at bombing because they sent scout planes over a few days before. So they pushed their big battleships and their Navy ships back to Palau. But the merchant ships were still unloading. They were sort of ferrying cargo to Chuuk or on its way to Rabaul or other places down south for their sort of guarding against the American fighting. So there were many, many merchant ships and sailors and soldiers coming there to help defend the base that went down with the ships and equipment, cargo planes that went down. Over 350 aircraft were destroyed, and only a handful of those had actually been found. So there's many more of those that could be found, you know, along with the missing in action people, that the pilots that went down with them. And there's a number of American and Japanese groups that are still looking for those planes for possibly that could find human remains with them.
Well, this project that you're undertaking now, you're going to be surveying three new shipwrecks that we don't know much about?
Most of the big ships are known in Chuuk Lagoon, but I come across my research many years ago about three smaller ships. So they're a bit away from the main concentration of shipwrecks. So I want to look for them, and that'll give us an idea of the flora and fauna has been there and has been there for some time, whereas the other shipwrecks visited by people and by tourists, and sometimes they interfere with what's remaining. Dynamite fishing has been carried out on these shipwrecks because, they, as I said, they carry lots of munitions and lots of stores as well. And so the dynamite fishing has been carried out, and that stripped the corals off of a lot of these ships and impacted the fauna, the fish too. So to find these new shipwrecks, it would be quite interesting to see, you know, what's on them, because part of our work is looking at the marine biology work and the ecology, the broader sort of part of the biology of these shipwrecks. Because one of the things the FSM national government are looking at maybe nominating this area for World Heritage listing, and they want to look at not just the cultural aspect, but the natural flora and fauna. I mean, many of the divers that have been coming there for years, since, you know, in the 1970s. So it's a wonderland of flora and fauna. It is. It's just a beautiful place to dive. 30 degrees Celsius down to, 40 metres, 150 feet or so, 28 degrees maybe the coldest Celsius, not Fahrenheit, so it's still pretty warm, 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's clear water, and with all this flora and fauna, it's just a fantastic, beautiful place, apart from the historical, the war remains. And, hear of divers coming back and feeling quite teary about it, because you go there and it's still, ships are sitting upright. You can get the emotion of, you see all the sake bottles or beer bottles, and you swim inside and see the cabins, and there used to be some human remains there that you could see, but most of them have been taken away now and had the ceremonies, so you don't see much of them there. But you can get a strong sense of association with the war and the people when you dive the ships.
Yeah, I mean, it is a watery graveyard, and you have to give it the respect that it deserves, you know, for the lives that were lost deep in the ocean. And so, yeah, mapping out these areas where there's little known, it just helps our knowledge about that area.
The main things we're doing, while we work on the shipwrecks, we're concentrating a fair bit on the land, on the terrestrial, because the 18, 19 high volcanic islands inside the lagoon, and they all had military remains on them, and many of them were bombed. But the main island, Tonawos, that had something like 1,200 Japanese buildings on it during the war. Seaplane base, repair base, a floating dock, submarine base. There was a five airstrips in Chuuk altogether. A little island nearby, Eton, was one of its major airstrips there. So there was a lot of infrastructure built on these islands. So there used to be, when divers come and dive the wrecks, that they could then go off to Tonawos and look at this. But during COVID, things shut down and no one came. There were no dive tourism in Chuuk at that time. And the jungle took over. And the mayor, working closely with the mayor, Tonawos Cradovan Hasek, and also runs the Blue Lagoon Resort, he wants to try and revive, you know, this aspect of the tourism, the cultural tourism. And it gives people on the island a sort of a connection too, with people coming there, and they can get involved with the tourists and I mean, they can help each other out. There's many also Japanese tourists that go there and pay their respects to their fallen ancestors. There's memorials associated with the brother of the Emperor Hirohito, who went there in 1928. There's other memorials to Japanese people. So many sort of tourists used to go there and not so many now. And so we want to sort of help revive that aspect of it. But we also want to, which is very important, we want to say in our interpretation how the Chukis, you know, the traditional sites, the sacred sites, the spiritual sites, were impacted by the war, and not to leave them out of this sort of context. When they do this sort of thing, they look at the Japanese and American or maybe Australian sites, if there are, you know, the protagonist stuff. But they don't think about, well, what about local people? They were greatly impacted by the war, and it wasn't their sort of war, so innocent sort of people. So we want to bring that out in our work, and that's on the islands, not so much in the water, although there's sort of natural reef that would have sacred connection, you know, traditional connection that we could bring out as well, but mostly on the island. So it's a combination of the underwater shipwreck work, the marine biology, finding some new sites, and this sort of what's on the islands, the Japanese sites and the Chukis traditional sites that we want to portray. This is a holistic heritage from World War II, not just one or two aspects.
That was William Jeffrey, professor with the University of Guam, who, thanks to a grant from the American Battlefield Protection Program, will begin mapping three previously unknown shipwrecks from World War II. At that time, Chuuk was taken over by Japan, where they established a seaplane and submarine base, which was bombed by the U.S. in retaliation for the Pearl Harbor attack. Jeffrey says when he arrived there in Micronesia in 2001 from Australia, he realized that the stories of the islanders' perspective were overlooked. He hopes that the research will make that point of view more widely known to those who visit Micronesia. There are plenty of aquatic predators near the shore to worry about, but channel swimmers are concerned about another dangerous fish in the open ocean, cookie-cutter sharks. In the past decade, a handful of swimmers have been bitten while attempting to cross the Ka'iwi Channel between Oahu and Molokai. In some instances, multiple sharks attacked a single swimmer, carving out round pieces of flesh from their victim and leaving cookie-cutter-shaped bite marks. Take a listen to the story of one survivor from 2009, Michael Spalding.
2 years ago, he suffered a shark attack that would have kept most of us out of the water for good. Take a look at the damage done back in March of 2009 when Michael Spalding came face to face with a cookie cutter shark. He survived a bite to his calf and stomach, and he vowed to continue with the mission that put him in the water that day, swimming the 33-mile Alenuihaha Channel between the Big Island and Maui. At the age of 63 years old, he is now the oldest person to have swum the channel. Good morning, Michael, and thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Mahia. Thanks for this opportunity.
Wow, those were incredible pictures of those wounds there, and you were in the middle of swimming the channel, or as you actually just started the swim, when you were bitten a couple of years ago. Why don't you take us back to that time?
I started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and that was the time when the tide would be perfect, and about 10 miles into the swim, 5 hours after starting, at 8 o'clock at night, I got hit in the chest by the first bite, and It wasn't actually a deep bite. It was just like a pinprick, but it alerted me to the fact that I have to get out of the water as quick as possible.
Nobody knew what prompted these attacks until Stephen Manalia came along. He's a University of Hawaii urogynecologist who moonlights as a channel swimmer, and he found a striking association between cookie-cutter shark bites and moonless nights. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with him recently about his study.
2009, there was an attack on Mike Spalding. He was swimming from Big Island to Maui. The shark bit his calf. It made the news. I was just starting channel swimming at the time, so I remember it very vividly that I was reading it thinking, gosh, you know, what a thing to happen. And didn't make much of it until 2019. A friend of mine was the first victim in March, And then there were two others. And it's a small community, so we all know each other, right? I thought, well, I wonder why this is happening and why all of a sudden. Maybe it's just that there's more people in the water. I didn't really know what to make of it. But you had trouble finding a boat captain who would take you out?
Maybe tell me a little bit about how you got into channel swimming.
So I did my first races in 2009, and by 2011, I had swam my first channel, and I was really interested in it. And then I think in the first 10 years of swimming, I did 26 channel crosses. It was traveling internationally to do the swims, Japan, Spain, New Zealand, et cetera, Greece, and just got really into it. In 2020, I was probably at my peak, and I had just swam around Manhattan in 2019, I was incredibly trained and ready to go. But I was really terrified. And that year, 2020, it was just me and my training partner at the time. We swam Kaivi, the only two crossings that year. And I chose a full moon because my theory was maybe when it's so dark, this nocturnal hunter can, you know, effectively hunt. People say a lot of things. They're anecdotal. You talk to captains, don't do this, don't do that. It'll draw the sharks. And you always wonder how valid these statements are. And some are very, very valid and based on probably hundreds of years of experience. But often the person proclaiming it doesn't know where it came from. There was some literature at the time that actually said if the moon was up, you were more likely to be attacked by the shark. There was no data supporting that. And so I didn't get bit, she didn't get bit, but on a full moon, the current swings are so massive, we were going backwards for hours at times.
Wow.
And so it took so long to swim that channel with a full moon, I thought, okay, there's got to be something else here. The other research I do is on when's the best time to do a channel swim, and full moons are not. Yeah.
Well, the sharks are going to be there, but on the other hand, it's going to be a terrible experience.
Yeah, yeah. A long and drawn-out experience.
So. Yeah.
Alinui Haha and Kaivi channels are so long that the odds that a swimmer is going to be swimming in the dark is very, very high. So that's kind of what I was thinking. Full moon, plenty of light, less shark likelihood of attack. And I was thinking specifically of cookie cutters because I'm not particularly concerned with tigers. Tiger sharks are such a higher level organism.
Yeah.
Cookie cutters are a whole different animal. They're bottom feeders.
Yeah.
Not exactly. I mean, they have to rise to the surface to feed, but they dwell at thousands of meters below the surface. And they're 2 feet long. So you can imagine the brain capacity is not very large, right? So I didn't think that cookie cutters would be anything like other shark species.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, they're nocturnal, so they probably prefer darkness to give them a competitive advantage for hunting.
Sure.
If you look at it, tigers have not attacked channel swimmers. They tend to attack surfers, right? And many of us are out there thousands of miles a year, and we're not getting attacked. Why is that? So
yeah, and then on the other hand, why is it the cookie cutters?
So in 2021, Nat Geo basically hired a friend of mine and I to reenact one of the bites. So we were the swimmers posing as victims. And in 2022, in the summer, the episode aired. They had spoken with some of the most renowned marine biologists who have all this knowledge about this rare species of shark. And it was humbling that at the end, there was really no conclusions. You know, the temperature, the water, the time of the year didn't really matter. So again, I thought, there's nothing here. I don't know if anything will happen. And then I heard of another two bites, and that's when the signal really went off. Once I knew about the sixth victim, and I noticed that five of the six victims were bitten when the moon was absent from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, they were bitten in almost the same location within the channel. And I noticed that it was very, very deep where they were swimming over. So I thought, okay, it's very dark and it's very deep. Why is that? The only way to prove a theory that dark is a risk factor was I had to look at the people swimming in the light and find out what was unique about them. And that's when the project really took off.
Does that then mean, so those controls, like were you one of the controls?
Yes.
Yes. How often do you think that happens? Like a researcher uses themselves.
Yeah, it's very strange when you swam it yourself, you reenacted a bite victim's experience, and then you just go to sleep every night thinking about this in the back of your mind. Like, what is the scientific problem at hand, and how do we solve it? it's nice to be this close to something and have really been so passionate about it. I'm a urogynecologist. My job is an editor at the journal and to teach residents and students and take care of patients. And my close friends are like, now you're doing shark research? How did that happen? I said, well, I was close to a person in the Hawaiian Channel Swimming Association who shared data with me many years ago. So I actually made my own Excel spreadsheets with mm-hmm. all the crossings historically, you know, dating back to 1961. And
yeah.
I was sitting on this mound of data, not really knowing what to do with it. But once I realized that these victims were in the dark, then I had all the data already. The parts that I was missing, which caused me basically to use Facebook and Insta to contact over 100 swimmers and wow. ask them, hey, did you have shark deterrents? Did you have any glow sticks or lighting? What kind of sunscreen? So again, once there were enough bites and I had all the data, I did it's a classic 2x2 table study. And as soon as I saw the p-value, I knew that there was something there.
And p-value, just for listeners, is the probability that something is due to random chance. So usually people say if p is less than 0.05 or 0.01, it constitutes something that's statistically significant. So what was the p-value in this case? 0.012.
With the relative risk confidence interval being 1.5. It indicates at least a 50% or more risk.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that is serious, even in small sample sizes, to say there's at least a 50% risk of this happening on a moonless night.
Yeah, it's very critical, right?
What explanation did you come up with for this association? Like, what might be going on here?
I had no idea. I thought, okay, maybe it's just because they like the dark and now they can hunt in the dark. And I would talk about the research with colleagues in surgery, you know, at the hospital with my residents or students, just, you know, randomly. Huh, I found this out, but I don't know why. And one day, an anesthesiologist, Dr. Takebayashi, he's acknowledged in the paper, he said, well, when we go out fishing, we really like when it's really dark, because if they drop lights in to the water, they can aggregate all these small fish and prey items to basically hook bigger fish.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but that's been my experience. Maybe talk to Dr. Pedro. He's out there in the dark a lot. So I called Patrick Pedro, a general surgeon at Queens, and he just basically said the same thing. And I thought, okay, this is the interpretation of the data as best as I can put it. And then I went on to speak to other fishermen who do really deep sea fishing at all hours of the day. And mm-hmm. I got recognition that, hey, if it's the moon is gone and you put some lights in the water, the fish aggregate. When the moon is up and it's so bright, the fish are everywhere. They're scattered and you can't aggregate them with a lighted device. And that's where the human behavior element comes into it, right? Channel swimmers are terrified. Pilots more so are terrified of losing the swimmer in big surf or big waves, rather, in the middle of the channel, in the middle of the dark. So we all wear glow sticks and strobe lights and all sorts of lighted equipment that's artificial that potentially could aggregate fish. And it probably gains aggregative ability the darker it is.
But has the feedback from the channel swimming community been positive? Have people been receptive to these recommendations?
I get a kind of a mixed feeling. I mean, some people in the channel swimming community, since it's something we can't control, they just prefer to keep their head down and ignore things. I was always like that. You can't control the environment, so what for, right?
Yeah.
And just swim and do your best and show up as prepared as an athlete as you can. And I respect that viewpoint. And I'm not trying to really change that mentality. It's just now that the research is out, it's very clear. You want to avoid the very dark part of the channel and the darkest part of the night. If you can have the sun up or you can have the moon up when you're crossing the depths of those channels, it's optimal. And that's all. It's basically to kind of influence behavior on planning, not to change the heart or the spirit of the swimmer and say, oh, don't go out at all because sharks are, I mean, you would never go in the ocean if you've bought into that, right? I guess it's just a new thing. We don't really take research tools and apply them to endurance sports.
Going forward, is there anything you'll be looking for this season as people start to cross this channel?
The Kaivi Channel crossing season is just about to start, but all the people who were part of the study have already responded back, and everyone's very jazzed about it. I'm going to keep a close eye on everyone who succeeds and try to look at perhaps just the recurring patterns in the data. So I look at it as, I mean, maybe it's a lifetime of research into this. I don't think we're finished with it.
So even though the paper came out, this is still a topic that keeps you up at night, that you're going to keep updating that Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
That was Stephen Manalia of the Queen's University Medical Group and the John A. Burns School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii. His paper was published this past February in the Public Library of Science One Journal. He shared that he met the co-author of the study, coincidentally, while channel swimming from Maui to Lanai last year. Stay with us. We'll continue with our Interesting Jobs Hanaho show after the break.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Nico's Pier 38, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner featuring fresh fish from next door's fish auction. With open-air dining and live entertainment, open daily. Menus at nicospier38.com.
Here in Hawaii, there's a special appreciation for things that are local. And we take that seriously at HPR, where 30% of the programs you hear are made in-house by our own team. Everything from Morning Cafe to The Conversation, Bridging the Gap to Evening Jazz. Whether you're a news junkie or a music lover, HPR's local programming keeps you rooted in our shared island community. Learn more about our shows at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art with HOMA Nights, open until 9 p.m. Fridays for art experiences, stargazing in the courtyards, music, dinner, and drinks. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. Today we're featuring stories of people whose careers aren't run-of-the-mill. Punahou alum Susan Stanton won her second Primetime Emmy Award recently. She's a producer and writer on the HBO series Succession, which was named Outstanding Drama Series. It centers around the rich and powerful Roy family, led by patriarch Logan Roy, who owns the multi-billion dollar company Waystar Royco. Throughout the series' four-year run, audiences watched as the four Roy children vied with other family members and company executives for control of the company. The Conversation's Russell Subiono talked with Stanton about writing for the series and why last year's strike was so important.
How do you write for a family that is so different from families as we know it here?
Well, I mean, I think it is and it isn't, you know? Like, in some ways, I think that you could look at them and say, oh, they're despicable. And there are. And I think even as we progress in the show, for various characters, we've had them be really despicable, but hopefully have a heart. And then I think at times where maybe we feel too much for a character, we have to sort of have them like counterbalance it. But in a way, a lot of people have told me that they've seen things, the power struggle, the things in a lot of different families, you know, like in Hawaii and other places, like places, families that have, you know, a family business or a complicated sibling structure. I mean, you know, the way that I think, like, let's say a parent dies and there's an estate dispute, you know, or a pressure from an oldest child to take over, or pressure from maybe like a daughter to caretake more. Like, I feel like these power imbalances in the siblings, like who's the favorite? I mean, I think it's on a larger, more Baroque scale because they're the children of billionaires. And so you could say it couldn't be more different than us. But I think in some ways, they're also actual siblings, like even in the physicality of the characters playing the siblings, like they'll wrestle or they'll do like silly voices that maybe they did when they were, you know, eight. And so there's ways in which it couldn't be more different. And then I think there's ways in which that it's familiar. And for the writers of the show, I mean, none of us grew up anywhere close to any of that. But, you know, we all put sort of our family stories or childhood memories or relationships, you know, like it's kind of a stew where we take real historical events and events from the news, but also things that have happened kind of in our own lives or to, you know, other friends. And it kind of all feeds it and gets changed. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm curious. I'm so inside of it that I couldn't say, but I think the way that people are connecting to the show is because maybe it does remind them of a complicated sibling dynamic, or maybe from a distant father who they admire, you know, or a separated mother. Like, I feel like some of these stories are still a part of it.
There's times in which we'll take a look at politics or top-down things or a merger or just some things where you might read about it in the Wall Street Journal. And then I think we'll also try to look at things that are really familiar and actually like very silly, because it's a comedy. So I think there are times in which scenarios will get very, very ridiculous. I mean, it's a, you know, or it's a, I would say it's a hybrid. It's a drama and it's a comedy, but some of the heights it reaches comedy wise are very ridiculous.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but was there anything specific that you wrote into the series, whether it was a character or a particular quirk or a dialogue exchange that was distinctly you or came directly from you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, so many things. I mean, you know, we all worked as a team, but I don't know. I mean, it feels weird to give you a laundry list. I was proud that I gave Tom Wamsgans his last name because that became a thing in the show.
Uh-huh.
Actually, this is very Hawaii. In season 4, I got the Roy Sidhu Kataoke, which was, I feel like, a real Hawaii victory for me. I kept trying to get us to shoot in Hawaii, and we almost did a couple mm-hmm. of times, but it ended up not being practical for our shooting schedule. So we ended up in Barbados, but I was like, let's get them to Hawaii, you know? Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously I had my own episodes and different storylines, but no, I mean, I mean, a lot of things, I think, like either research ideas I brought in or personal storylines, but you know, it all becomes a hybrid where things get morphed. Bore on the Floor, which was a thing people was really interested in. I had done a theater writing retreat next to a corporate hunting lodge. And so I saw executives hunting deer. And then we were shooting off season. And so I was researching, like, what animals can you kill in March? And so deer became, you know, boar. And then it sort of went from there.
Tom!
Yes?
Sit on the floor. It's fun.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's a game. Boar on the floor.
I feel...
Get down! Boar on the floor! Boar on the floor! Kendall, ring the troops! Boar on the floor!
Again, stories or research or even just brainstorming from our lives just became big parts of the show.
The last time we talked, you shared your journey on how you became a writer and a producer on Succession, how Jesse Armstrong liked your work and brought you into the writing room. What I'm curious about now that I've seen much of the series, what is it that attracted you to the series, aside from this incredible opportunity to work on a major show on a major network?
I was a big admirer of Jesse for a really long time. I mean, I love Peep Show. I loved just the savagery of the writing and in the thick of it, and a lot of just the ways that I think Brits, but him in particular, can really write satire and still have it be dramatic. There was just something about the writing and the execution that I just thought was so special and different. So that was something, I think, in the show. I think it was exciting for me to be in London as well. The writer's room was in London. And I mean, what the Hawaii of it is, like, it's so far away. It's half a world away. But even in New York, I think, and being an American, it's hard to have international conversations. And so I love that it was a British and American room. And we're having these conversations about American media and what that looks like. And there are people looking at it from the outside and people from the inside. And I think also just being from Hawaii, it's like different than being, I don't know, more traditionally American. And so I also kind of felt like I had one foot in, one foot out in terms of looking at the broader, like the sort of the continent of it. It's a different perspective when you're from Hawaii, I think. And so there's a distance, I think, geographically and just also in terms of looking at what America is and how the news cycle is, how money and power is, you know. And so, yeah, I think it was, you know, it's been the ride of my life. And I think especially from the beginning, I could tell the rigor of the show, the level of the research we were asked to do, but also we wanted to do, the level of acting. Like, it just felt like from the very beginning, like everything just felt like it was on a really high level, and it stayed that way. I've done other shows since. And so it was my first show. And so in some ways, they feel like I came in really, really lucky. And then I've done other shows that I've loved, but I've never been a part of another show where we've done as many rewrites on drafts. We've done as much research. We're on set every single day of shooting, writing new lines. And so we're just kind of attacking it constantly. Everyone is trying to make it as good as it can possibly be. The actors are sending questions and doing their own research. And so I think it's just accumulation of everybody bringing absolutely everything they have to it in a way that I've never seen on anything else to the same level. I know it exists, but I haven't really felt just like from every single department. It's been very moving.
Last year, we saw the Writers Guild go on strike for 148 days. Pay is always a big component whenever organizations go on strike. But I know that the use of artificial intelligence in movies and television was a big issue for both the writers and the actors. Can you help our listeners understand why artificial intelligence is such a real threat to your profession and to others in the entertainment industry?
Yeah, I mean, it's really scary. I know this happens with college professors for students where ChatGPT kind of thing, where it's like you can have an AI create a song or a story and create a version of that. And the technology continues to improve. So for instance, like I know like for soap operas, maybe you feed in 40 years of a soap opera and then you get something that's pretty good. And then you just hire a writer to punch it up. You know, like you still need a human, but you could get along pretty far before you actually hire a writer to write it. So maybe on like the highest level, the sort of like Nobel Prize winning or just very high level of like television writing, you're like, okay, you can't fake that. But, you know, I mean, you have robots that can play chess on an extreme level, you know, right. So you get these simulations that are continuing to increase. And so I think that was the scary thing, is just feeling like we're just going to be hired to kind of like rewrite things, or even that AI was going to generate a story that you get paid to adapt. And I'm sure you've heard the model of writing, the way streaming has worked, like the amount of money that writers were receiving had already declined proportionately just because of the model had changed in the streaming. And then for actors too, I mean, this was more for background actors, but it's a way a lot of actors make their living. The majority of SAG, it's that everyone thinks about, you know, A-list movie stars, but that's not the case. And it's also a way a lot of actors get their training. And there was an idea of like, you can scan actors and it's kind of like the background people in a video game, and they'll pay them, I don't know the amount, like $200, and then have their likeness forever. You know, it's right. Kind of like a Black Mirror episode. And they do that now even for crowd scenes. They'll have certain, you know, extras in the background. They'll tile them in a big crowd scene. And I guess in some ways with COVID and practicality, that makes sense. But yeah, it just, things were moving in a really scary direction. And I think the Guild was kind of saying, we're worried about this. And their counter offer, at least initially, was like, we'll let you talk about it with us for one meeting a year. That was their counterpoint. We're like, please promise you won't replace us with AI. And they said, well, you can talk to us about it once a year. And we're not going to do anything to limit technology. And, you know, I don't know. I understand in certain ways that position, but in terms of just it being an expression of humanity and empathy, and, you know, it's just like, do you really need robots to do this aspect of it just to save money? Like, the whole point is we're trying to reflect our culture, our society, like tell stories. You know, it's a deeply, deeply human thing that you're trying to save money and have robots do. So it was a pretty scary debate. I think it was one of the biggest sticking points for the strike and something that we were fighting really hard on. I think the pay was another big thing, but I think for me and a number of other people, it was just trying to have protections against AI. And it felt like this was the one time where we could really push back against that. You know, the last time we really had a longer strike was in some ways to get health insurance and get a pension plan. And that has helped so many writers, and it helped a lot of writers through the strike as well. So I don't know. I'm glad to be on the other side of it. We're still sort of feeling the effects of it, but it was a long one, but I'm glad we're through it.
Susan Stanton, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
That was Susan Stanton talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about the impact of AI on Hollywood writers. Stanton says she's currently working on a new play with Maui director Mina Morita. Stanton says her hope is to be at the helm of her own TV series someday. More recently, she branched out into writing for opera. She wrote her first libretto, The New Ending, commissioned by the Washington National Opera to Puccini's final unfinished work, Turandot. It was performed this past May at the Kennedy Center Opera House. There's a new kid in the candy aisle. After raising more than $1 million in funding, Best Friends, Bella Hughes, and Samira Nico developed a line of healthy, fruit-flavored sour gummy candy that drew inspiration from their Iranian heritage and growing up in Hawaii. Better Sour launched last May in the Los Angeles retail market with help from local investors. And now the gummies are here in Hawaii. The conversation's Lillian Song sat down with Hughes and Nico in our studio.
The Iranian or broader Middle Eastern flavors that we're currently celebrating in one of our SKUs are pomegranate, apricot, and plum. You can find these flavors all across our savory, mostly savory and sour dishes, but also some sweet. So what we're doing Better Sour is really making candy more inclusive, more flavorful, more exciting with the flavors that we grew up with and we know are absolutely delicious.
Review those six flavors you carry. That's three each in two different bags.
Yes. So what are those in packs? Industry terms, we call them SKUs, but two different bags. And one bag, the one Samira just was referencing, is a nod to our Iranian-American heritage and just greater flavors from the Middle East. It's a pink bag for all those listeners who are going to be looking for this one. And that's the one that has the pomegranate, apricot, plum. Then there's a green bag, and this one really is an homage to our childhood in Hawaii. You've got calamansi, ume, and guava. Both bags are a single serving, and they are 1.8 ounces with only 60 calories and 3 grams of sugar. And really important for us, I mean, we grew up going to farmers markets before they were trendy. This is in the late 80s, early 90s. Our parents were total down-to-earth, Kukua Market customers. It was all about creating something effortlessly healthy, very, very clean. It tastes like an indulgence, but really, really natural product. And again, a super nice low sugar content. I think for Samira and I, what we really love is that gummy candy is truly something global. So we're taking a very familiar form factor. You find gummies in Germany, you find them in Taiwan, you find them across the United States, you find them here in Hawaii. And we're taking something that everyone's familiar with. It's really a global commodity, but we're imbuing it with flavors from our heritage, our story, but also it complements this rising trend that you've been seeing over the last few years in consumer packaged goods, in natural, better-for-you products of global flavors, of heritage-rich brands and stories. Growing up, we didn't like the candy on the market. We felt that, especially when you're looking at sour candy, it was very gimmicky, where it would burn your tongue off in the gummy set, and then it was almost sickeningly sweet. And we really wanted to capture that pleasant tartness that we grew up enjoying in fresh or dried fruits. And I think most listeners here in Hawaii can probably relate.
Yeah, I would add to that that we want, when folks eat our candy, to really have it remind them of the fruits and fruit-derived snacks that they grew up with or currently are enjoying, not necessarily the other candy that they're eating. You know, you bite into our calamansi, it does taste like a calamansi. It just perhaps is a little more indulgent and in fun gummy form.
You guys bring your strengths to the table. So, Samira, you come from a legal background. Mm-hmm. I know Bella from the arts, first launched the Honolulu Biennial, now Triennial. People may also recognize you through Shaka Tea.
Mm-hmm.
As women entrepreneurs, founders, can you share insight on the process? Because you guys have really gone from that idea to physical product in the aisle. What has that process been like?
I will say this as a repeat founder. I was so intimidated originally by the world of business. I thought you needed to go get an MBA. You had to have an amazing financial acumen. math was my worst subject in high school, true story. So I think what I learned on this journey is you really need a passion. Being an entrepreneur means you're going to think about your business 20 hours a day. Any listener who's thinking of going into business who's might feel intimidated, if you've got a big passion to bring something to life and it doesn't exist yet, grit, persistence, and that love of your product, you know, for Samira and I, and sharing a story really, really has been the guiding light for us.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Bella said. I feel like I cheated a little bit coming to this partnering with Bella because she's had this incredible and a professional career as an entrepreneur. But what I can tell from my experience in the short time I've been doing this is truly it is the grit and having kind of a holistic approach to what you're doing. It's not just going to be numbers. It's not just going to be branding, not just the product. You have to be involved in all aspects of the business. And failure is inevitable in steps of it or maybe the whole endeavor, but that shouldn't stop someone. We've had failures even in our short journey. And always I can say we have learned from it and it's ultimately benefited us in some way.
Well, I'm curious because you guys are besties and with failures, how did you work through that? Or can you just share a quick story? Like what sort of failure maybe comes to mind right now that we can all learn from?
Well, oh, I'm thinking about the using natural plant dyes and colors. So with our first run of our product, our calamansi did not look green. And all the colors in the pink bag basically looked the same. So it was really, really hard to visually. We were out there sampling and demoing, and there's just a lot of learning when you're making a product, learning about exactly, especially if you're working with dyes that derive truly from plants, nothing artificial or fake. But just rolling with it, kind of, I would say we made some jokes on trade show floors of like, it's a very natural product. And then quickly like pivoting, working with our co-packer.
Yeah, always finding a positive angle. That is very key, which I think Bella is just exceptional at. And people always say, you know, what I actually have heard in the past is don't go into business with your friends, especially when challenging times hit. It could really break not just the business, but the friendship. But what I can say is going into business with your lifelong best friend when you've had every single fight in the book, from pulling each other's hair to having silent treatments, writing angry letters. When you hit these bumps in the road, we know how to work it out. We've done this before. So any bump in the road we've had, and I'm sure more in the future, we know each other's flow and we kind of work off of each other and the creative process to figure it out.
Right. There's no one I trust emotionally more to be a co-founder with than my best friend of 36 years. There's just such a level of trust. Being an entrepreneur can be very messy and very ugly because there's so many uncertainties. Challenges. Even if you've done it before, gummy candy is very different than my experience in herbal iced tea. And there's just a lot of learnings. And to have someone that you can go through stressful times with, but have such a deep level of emotional intimacy and trust, I say is truly one of our strengths. I've never been happier than being in business with my best friend.
I agree.
That's so sweet that you share that lifetime bond, that emotional trust with each other. And my mind is actually pinging back to what you were saying about how in one bag, all the colors look the same. And calamansi actually wasn't green. But at this point,
yes, we fixed that. But I remember for a hot minute, we could have either freaked out at our first trade show or we could really see the positive, make a joke out of it and just roll with the punches. And there's so many incidents of this happening. I mean, truly, it happens weekly. That's just the first one that popped in my mind, and that's being a startup. Mm-hmm.
I will say the calamansi, we took a big risk. We had our first production run. It was ready 3 days before when we were launching at the major trade show in the industry. And I remember trying and opening a bag for the first time before driving to the trade show and nearly having a heart attack. But it worked out. We were able to sell it. It ended up being a top selling product in our early accounts. And we just figured out how to fix the issue for the next time around.
And we even won an award. There's a group called Startup CPG, and our pomegranate apricot plum with that first production run where the colors looked, again, quite similar, won best new sweet. We were joking with them. We said it should be best new sour. Maybe sour will be a category.
Good point. And since we are radio, and as you have better sour here in the studio, this would be a great time to do tasting in an auditory way.
Oh, how fun.
Bust them out. All right, so Samira's holding the pink bag. Bella's got the green bag.
Want to hear all that crunch?
That's the green bag. Oh, Bella, did you have the sound of the zipper opening?
Oh, I don't know. That was great.
It's very enthusiastic.
Okay, where's that calamansi?
Right over here. See that nice green?
Let's see. Got it. I don't know if you are a person who likes to bite into their candy or who loves to enjoy it.
We actually learned a lot discussing this with our husbands about gummy suckers.
My husband is a gummy sucker. I did not know that was a thing.
Because my husband, myself, and Samira are gummy chewers. So there's a whole new category of just how people...
How you can enjoy gummies.
Because I will admit, I tend to enjoy it on the long term.
Oh, so you're also a gummy sucker.
I'm a gummy sucker. This is pleasant.
What?
It's got a little sweet, but I get the tart. So I also really appreciated how you're telling me on the back of each bag, you share your brand story. Samira, share that with us.
Our name says it all. We love sour. We live for that flavorful, mouthwatering tang. That's why we've created these sour gummies using global flavors from the Middle East to the Asia Pacific. We're Iranian-American best friends raised in Hawaii, here to unleash sour power. Bella and Samira.
Life is better sour.
That was Better Sour founders Samira Nico and Bella Hughes talking with HPR's Lillian Song. Look for the hot pink or bright green bags at markets like Foodland, Down to Earth, and KTA. That is it for our Aloha Friday Hanaho show about interesting jobs. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. The conversation is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and Tori DeJournay. Mahalo to John DeMello for the Backyard Quiz, and mahalo to Gypsy 808 for our theme music. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.